So, session two of our class. I'd like to begin each class with just a moment when anyone who has leftover issues or questions or things they thought about from the previous class, if there's any follow-ups you want to raise. I also wanted to just very briefly talk about a couple of items that I didn't fully discuss. Does everybody have an outline, by the way? Because the... Yeah, pass this down to Michael. So first, though, any issues left from the last session? Any questions? And you should know that since I'm going to do this at the beginning, give you an opportunity, this is also something in your mentoring groups you can talk about, if the timing is right. It's something you want to raise to the class as a follow-up from the previous session. Yeah?
I have a question from the book, actually. Under the section where it talks about viability, it mentions the importance of contextual conditions and the historical context as well, but it doesn't really talk about the speed of possible transformation. And I was wondering if that's something that we'll talk about later, or if that's not as important yet a consideration for viability.
So, the speed of transformation bears more on the question of the achievability of a transformation than in general on its viability. But that's it's a really interesting question. So let me just, this was one of the things I was going to add on my leftovers because I didn't really go through them. So that's a nice segue. It's the second bullet point under a few leftovers from the last lectures in the handout. So I argue that there are really these three tasks. Remember, there's diagnosis and critique of the world as it is, envisioning alternatives, and a theory of transformation. And in thinking about alternatives, then, there were these three criteria, all of which are relevant, and they're kind of nested in a way. There's the desirability of an alternative. Surely we don't want to struggle to create undesirable alternatives, so you want to establish the principles of desirability. Then there's the viability of an alternative. And by viability, I mean the following. If you get there, can you stay there? So some alternatives, which might be really desirable, if you were actually to snap your fingers and create a world with that, they would self-destruct. They would have unintended consequences or perverse effects or internal contradictions such that they would not constitute a stable equilibrium. So, viability refers to the robustness of a institutional design, of an alternative possible world, of a new form of social relations. And you're asking, given what we know about how people are, about the kinds of flexibility and inflexibility that we know about people, and the way institutions work, is it likely, or do we have any reason to believe that this alternative would actually be sustainable? That's the viability question. And then the third part about envisioning alternatives is achievability. Can we mobilize the necessary social forces to actually create it? Now, I think one way of thinking about Paula's question about the speed of transformation is this. It could be that in some circumstances, an alternative is viable if you can get there quickly. But if you try to do it too slowly, then it wouldn't be stable, right? Because it may be that if you do it slowly, then there's too many opportunities for scheming to go on to subvert it in some way. But it could be the other way around. That is, if you try to do it quickly, then it can't be stable. The only way to make it stable is to do it slowly. Because the only way for it to be stable would be if people are transformed in the process of building the alternative. So there is a connection between the speed of transformation and viability. In the early 1990s, when the Soviet Union collapsed, and the historic question, what should the new institutions be, was on the table, the dominant theory of the new institutional process was what was called shock therapy. That was the term used to describe the problem of dismantling the old order and building the new. Right? The shock therapy doctrine with respect to the Soviet Union, now then which became Russia, was you had to absolutely smash and sweep clean the old institutions rather than try to slowly build the new ones. Because otherwise the old apparatchiks and nomenklatura and party bosses, they would all be able to manipulate the process and subvert it to their own purposes. So you had to destroy it wholesale, which of course led to an absolute traumatic devastation of the whole economic structure, in especially in the Soviet Union, but to a lesser extent in other countries. It was the, by all historical records, the largest decline in the standards of living of a large population ever recorded. And a massive reversal in life expectancies. You know, it was just a horrendous, traumatic decade. But the theory behind it was that there was a connection between what would be a viable alternative and how fast you had to move to get there. So, but viability in general, though, refers not to the transformation process per se, but to what you're trying to transform into. Okay? Any other questions, either from the readings or from the last lecture? All right, well, let me just add my leftovers. I wanted to say a little bit about the question of science. I think we touched on that a little bit, but it's a theme that's going to come up over and over. And it's certainly an issue which any of you who plan to, you know, teach in this area, to pursue activist and radical scholarship within the university, it's something you have to come to terms with and figure out your own views on. This idea for Marxism in particular and for emancipatory theory in general, what it means to say it aspires to be a social science. Not merely social criticism, but a form of social science. There are many people on the left who are very suspicious of claims of science. And indeed, there's a well-established position in these debates which says science is just another ideology. And indeed, it's an ideology of domination. So like all ideologies which are in the service of power, science is in the service of power. This is a very common position. It's identified sometimes with what's called postmodernism, this kind of anti-science view. That perspective on science was particularly strong in the late 80s and 90s. It's waned a bit as we've experienced what happens when the right wing takes over an anti-science view. You know, global warming, poof, it's just a theory. Evolution, poof, it's just a theory. You know, we're now confronting the discrediting of knowledge as an important political tendency, and therefore how it completely undercuts the possibility of rational discussion about how to solve problems. Right? If you really discredit the value of science and you don't distinguish between scientific practices to produce knowledge and just the way anybody might produce their own beliefs, if you really say there's no difference, everything is just the same, it's just perspective, then you really dig yourself into a hole when you want to argue against global warming deniers. Because it's just your point of view compared to their point of view. And they, you know, there's this terribly sad story in a way. There's the around the global warming issue, there's a small island in the South Pacific that is under, it has a close ties to Australia, but it's not an Australian territory, which is going to disappear. You know, it's one of these small island parts of the, I don't know if it's a, I don't remember, Nauru or something, I'm not sure. At any rate, it's one of the islands that's going to disappear. It has 10,000, 20,000 people on it. They're going to have to go somewhere. Australia has agreed that they will create a settlement for them in Australia with full, you know, process of becoming citizens. They will deal with that particular part of the problem. The people on that island are Christian fundamentalists from missionaries. They said after the flood, God promised Noah that there would never be another inundation. So they think global warming is complete nonsense because of biblical authority, right? Well, you know, Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry hold similar views that it's so I think it's very dangerous, actually, to go the full route of postmodernism and say everything is just perspective, and to make no distinctions in the character of the knowledge you produce through different practices. Okay, that's the first point. Yeah.
In terms of that objectivity, subjectivity split, I mean, you do, I'm sure you recognize the difference between physical sciences and social sciences. I mean, it's one thing to say, oh, it's just your opinion that the Earth is now a certain temperature. But when you talk about social sciences and say, oh, it's just your opinion that these particular social institutions are desirable, or something like that.
Well, that they're desirable, because that implies you're implying a value judgment. But that they cause children to die from malnutrition, and you may like that may be fine, you know, you may think that's a good thing, but I think social science is just as scientific as natural sciences, and absolutely down the line just as scientific. It's just that it's harder. it's just harder. It's a more difficult domain of generating knowledge than the natural sciences. And it has its own specificities. It has this peculiar feature, which is fantastically interesting, that our theories of the social world are also part of the social world we study and affect the world which we study. Now, that's a really interesting feature of social science that's not present. Marxism is a social science about capitalism, but it also affects capitalism because people adopted it and it became the source of social and political movements. So this kind of, it's a sort of double reflexivity. You know, reflexivity means you think about how your ideas are generated and what their impact is, but the very way you think about that has an impact, right? So it's very complicated. But I don't think it means that it's all becomes just a matter of opinion. There are good and bad arguments. There's arguments that correspond to evidence, and there's arguments that ignore the evidence. There's arguments that depend upon lying about the facts of the matter, and arguments that depend upon getting the facts right. And I have no problem with the category facts. That is, that there are observations which are robust and observations which are not. Now, none of this means that to affirm science, you have to affirm some kind of absolute truth with certainty. So one of the mistakes that gets made in these discussions about science and ideology and all these kinds of things is the incorrect belief that to affirm science is to affirm certainty. So when we say that according to the best scientific evidence, a significant component of global warming is human contribution through carbon emissions and so on, when we say that that's the result of science, we don't mean, and we're 100% certain that this is 78% of the problem, right? And that there's no possible way in which we could be wrong. No, what science insists upon is the inherent provisionality of any knowledge claim, always subject to criticism and revision. It's the rejection of absolute standards. But that doesn't mean you can't make judgments about the relative merits of one knowledge claim to another. Now, I think Marxism aspires to be a social science, and emancipatory social science in general needs to take the scientific quality seriously and be constantly vigilant about the traps of wishful thinking. You know, so because people engaged in this kind of work are deeply committed to social change and political projects, there's always the danger, which is probably greater among strong advocates and politically committed people than in people who are less passionate about social change. There's always the danger that you end up distorting the evidence and silencing certain arguments because it doesn't fit with your predispositions. Now, so the question of bias in radical thinking is a serious one, and it's one that we have to be vigilant about. But it's not disabling. It's just the problem. It's just an issue. So First point, I do think science is important. Second, I do think it's difficult, and you have to be vigilant about it. Also, though, I think Marxism in particular faces a very interesting set of specific problems around this issue of science. And that's because the very body of ideas that constitute the Marxist tradition have served two very different kinds of purposes, connected, but different. That is, this body of ideas is the foundations, the centerpieces of a revolutionary ideology. It does function as ideology, as a way of mobilizing people, inspiring people to be committed to a long-term project of social transformation. It gets incorporated into the beliefs of people in an emotionally laden way that is the stuff of political ideologies. So the particular way that ideas and emotions get connected is the stuff of the way ideologies work. That's why in the in revolutionary traditions, songs are important. Right? In the state capitol, one night last March, there was a fantastic rendition of Solidarity Forever with somebody had a big cymbals, and whenever it was Solidarity Forever, he would go bang like that. And, you know, chills went up my spine, I don't know about everybody else's, to be in the Wisconsin state capitol with a couple thousand people singing Solidarity Forever. Well, that's mobilizing very deep and powerful emotions of connectivity to a set of ideas. Because if you listen to the lyrics of that song, the lyrics of that song are straight classic Marxist ideas. It is we who built the whatever, you know, I'm terrible with lyrics, but it's fantastic lyrics. It's a kind of a textbook on the labor theory of value and exploitation. So Marxism functions as an ideology. What do ideologies do? They quell skepticism, they reduce your fears and anxieties, they give you certainty so you can be bold and act. Now that's exactly the opposite kind of cognitive process that you want from a social science. What you want in a scientific enterprise is continual skepticism, constant interrogation of the foundations of your own ideas, not to the point of disabling you, but from the point of view that you have humility, you know, that you don't take an arrogant stance towards your knowledge claims. You say, look, this is the best I can do at this point, and here's where I see the weaknesses of my own argument. A good scientific account in an emancipatory framework constantly points out the weaknesses in the arguments rather than sweeps them under the carpet. And the reason you want to point out the weaknesses of your arguments is because you want them to become better through the dialogue that happens when you are in conversation with others about theoretical ideas. So it's why in my own work on these kinds of issues, there's almost always a section where I say, here's what I don't understand. Here are the gaps in my argument. And it's a kind of plea for help to the community of people with whom I'm in dialogue. I don't have all the answers, and many of the things that I think I have the answers to are undoubtedly inadequate. It couldn't possibly be the case that I managed to get everything right. So there's got to be places that it can be improved. And please, I care about these ideas, therefore I want you to criticize them in order to make them better. Well, that's not the way you talk if you're trying to mobilize masses for a struggle. You want to impart certainty. So I'm characterizing this a bit. Not all ideologies have to be that absolutist, that totalizing, of course. There can be degrees of this. But the cognitive practice of science and the cognitive practice of ideological mobilization are different. They're different in the way they are connected to emotion, and they're different in their degrees of reflexivity. That is, how much they're constantly interrogating their own principles. And I think that's a deep tension. Yeah.
So this may be too much of a loaded question, but when do you make the leap, in your opinion, from just trying to be scientifically objective, not right, but scientifically objective, to, okay, now it's time for action, and even if I'm wrong, I need to mobilize and get people on the march and all that stuff, even if I don't have the perfect theory? When, in your opinion, do you think that?
I mean, I don't think there's a formula to answer that question. It depends upon circumstance entirely. And my own view is I'm very wary of the ideological side. I think while it seems effective and is for mobilizing purposes, it also has lots of traps. What is somehow necessary to do, however painful and difficult it is to simultaneously maintain the skepticism and the reflexivity and the constant questioning and the mobilizing energy, you know, which is an unstable combination. But that's what I think is needed. It may be the reason why I've mostly operated in the academic sphere, because that's what I'm comfortable with. I find it very hard to say things I don't fully believe in order instrumentally to get people to act. So to give the simplified, no qualifications, no doubts version of my arguments in a rousing speech, I just find very difficult. You know, I find it dishonest for me. I'm not making absolute judgments about this. And then
So in Burrowoy, I think I
said pronounced
name.
Burrowoy. Yeah, Burrowoy. Burrowoy. The W is pronounced with a V.
Oh, Burrowoy. Okay. He kind of, you know, critiques your idea here and says on page 94 of his essay, political struggles do not contaminate the pursuit of truth. They are the pursuit of truth. And that's just something that you fundamentally disagree.
Yeah, I think he's just being glib. And I don't think, I don't think in practice he would disagree that, you know, you see political struggles in which people who have dissenting views get silenced, and it turns out that their dissenting views were necessary to correct mistakes.
Doesn't that happen in academia as well?
Yeah, but in academia it's recognized as a sin. You know, of course, I mean, academia is filled with flaws. Science is supposed to be profoundly democratic in the sense that it's deliberative, the best arguments win, your authority and your status and your credentials should have zero relevance to the triumph of your ideas over others. That's the principle of science. Open, fully liberal in the, you know, classic sense discourse, fully deliberative. And of course it's violated all the time. There's patronage, there's behind the scenes dealings to get grants for your, you know, all that stuff happens. But it's completely recognized as a violation of norms and something which is struggled against, as opposed to seen as just fine because that's the way things ought to be. Yeah?
Is it possible in your mind then to create, or for there to be a space in society for like an ideology of
critical reevaluation that is like viable and achievable? So, as you'll see, when we get to the section of the course on ideology, we'll massage this idea of an ideology. And of course, there's a whole variety of possible ideologies. And some ideologies can be much more reflexive. That is, they can, and I think what that means is that they break the tightness of the connection between the emotional component and the and these ideas. They loosen it, not eliminate it, but loosen it, so that you can have more distance from the ideas which are part of your own motivations. So yes, I do think that's possible, and it's been argued that one of the problems that the left faces in liberal democracies is that the left is actually much more committed to liberalism in this idea sense than the right. And it disables them from being as doctrinaire and as rigid and willing to lie. You know, so that because I believe in the Enlightenment, I'm disabled in certain strategies which mobilize emotion for political purposes. There was another, any other? Okay, this is a set of ideas we will be returning to in different guises throughout the semester, this question of the scientific status of the Marxist tradition and what it means to really remain committed to that, and how it is or is not, or in what ways in tension to the ideological functions of this tradition for purposes of mobilizing for social change. All right. Now on to today's lecture and discussion. So this is the rest of this week and the next three lectures today and the next two lectures are a kind of introduction to the course as a whole. What I'm going to do today is discuss the concept of capitalism. This is the first pass in what will be a series of passes around this concept. So rather than attempt to pack into a single lecture a full account of a theory of capitalism, this is really just to get the parameters of this concept and to solve a number of key conceptual questions. On Wednesday, we're going to have fun, which is, you know, the critique of capitalism. That's, in a sense, the background condition for everything that follows. If it's the critique of capitalism, which then provides the motivation for seeking alternatives and a theory of transformation. And next Monday, I will chart the overall contours of a theory of transformation, since that will set the stage for our discussions of class formation, the state, and ideology. So this is all, in one sense, stage setting for the rest of the semester, but they're also discussions, I think, of substance in their own right. So today we're going to discuss what I'm describing as the anchor for the course, capitalism. I'd like to begin with some brief reflections on the problem of definitions and concepts. This is, again, something that's going to come up many times during the semester. A lot of this course has the character of elaborate, careful discussions of particular concepts. Sometimes I've heard students think the course is a bit like reading a dictionary, right? You know, a lot of it is about how we use words. And as you know, dictionaries are odd things because all the words are defined by other words in the dictionary. You know, a few words get defined by pictures. So the definition of a cow can be represented by a little photo of a cow. But, you know, dictionaries, languages have this problem that every word is defined by other words. The meaning of every concept depends upon its embeddedness in a theory of other concepts. So there is a kind of iterated process. You have to know the language before you can fully appreciate each word in the language, but you can't know the language unless you understand the words. Concepts get their meanings from theories, but theories are built of concepts. So you have to think of this as an iterated process. Iterated, that term means it's a kind of circular process that goes around and around and around many times. That's why we will revisit concepts in light of the subsequent theoretical elaboration. It's why by the end of the course, some of the things that you're learning at the beginning make more sense than they did on first hearing. It's why also you should just kind of relax and be patient and give yourself a break. You know, some of these things seem especially opaque or tricky. Some of them may remain opaque and tricky, but many of them will get clearer as you go on. Now, a note about the difference between words and concepts. The same word can be used to designate completely different concepts. And therefore, it's often very confusing in social discussions, both in ordinary life but also in theoretical discussions. People are often talking past each other. That expression, you know, different theorists are really talking past each other. That often comes from the fact they're using the same word, but they're actually meaning something very different. The best example we will have of that this semester is the word class. So the word class is a word that comes from the vernacular, from everyday speech. People use the term class. But it means something totally different Well, not, it's not totally different in the sense that there's some connection, but it's, the concept is radically different when it's used in the Marxist tradition from when it's used in the ordinary status attainment mainstream sociology tradition. In the mainstream sociology tradition, class is merely a way of locating yourself within a spectrum of inequality. So the middle class is just the middle of the income distribution. Yeah?
So you're referring to like the linguistic distinction between senses, of words?
Yeah, so there'd be ways of talking about this within linguistics, that the same word has different senses or meanings. I'm meaning that they really identify different concepts. So we have the same label, but it just is a label of two different concepts. So the Marxian concept of class is just an entirely different concept from the standard, what we will call gradational concept, even though it has the same label. They're both called class. And that's just something you have to be constantly attentive. So including in this session, when I use the word capitalism, I'm going to use it in a technical way, as it's been elaborated and developed in the Marxist tradition, which doesn't correspond to everybody else's use. For some people, capitalism just means a market economy. They don't distinguish between capitalist and non-capitalist forms of markets. That's the first comment. The second comment is a point that I think is not going to be familiar to most of you, at least not in a kind of refined way. And this is the problem of the level of abstraction at which you define a concept. So this expression, the level of abstraction, this is something that comes up a lot in philosophy of science discussions in social science. In most sociology courses, I don't think the level of abstraction problem is systematically explored. So what's going on in this notion of level of abstraction? Let me give you an analogy from biology, because the levels of abstraction in biology are so well ordered that it's a clearer case. So I, until a couple of years ago, had a wonderful dog named Ozzy. He was a corgi. And I could have brought Ozzy and he could have joined our class and he'd be scampering about entertaining everybody. And if I asked the question, what kind of a creature is this? So let's suppose you had never seen a dog, let alone a corgi, let alone my corgi. You didn't know what this was, and you asked, well, what is that? Now the question is ill-defined, because it depends what is that means compared to what? You know, you have to have a whole space of variation in order to give specificity to the that. Now, levels of abstraction is one way of organizing the answers to the question. So if you look at Ozzy, there's the following possible answers. What is that? It's my dog, Ozzy. That's a very concrete, specific, unique entity. He's a corgi, a dog, a canine, a mammal, an animal, a living thing. Right? So those are all correct answers to the question, what is that? But they're each, that's a sequence of abstractions, right? And the way you can think about it is, not all living things are animals, not all animals are mammals, not all mammals are canines, not all canines are dogs, not all dogs are corgis, and not all corgis are Ozzy, right? So that's a very clear nesting. Each of the lower levels is a form of variation of the higher level. And the sense in which you're becoming more abstract is you're becoming more encompassing of all the subtypes. Now, sometimes abstractions can make mistakes. So there was a time when dolphins and whales were thought of as fishes. So you'd have the category fish, and among the subtypes would be tuna and dolphin. Now we know that's incorrect, that there is no subtype of fish called dolphin, that it's a subtype of mammal that happens to swim in the sea, just like fish. It's an achievement of evolutionary biology and of the taxonomic side of evolutionary biology that they figured that out, that they got it right, that that was a scientific correction of a folk classification system. And that's what levels of abstraction do. They organize observations and claims about the nature of the world, about the kinds of things that exist in the world, and what are the sub-varieties. It's not that there is a unique hierarchy of abstraction. There could be more than one for different purposes. So levels of abstraction and concepts are always serving purposes within theories. But it's an achievement of a scientific perspective to organize its descriptions coherently in terms of levels of abstraction in that way. There isn't, therefore, in general, a correct level of abstraction. There's only a relevant level of abstraction for the kinds of questions you're asking. Now, it can matter a lot if you get it right or wrong. So, for example, a lake can be thought of as a body of water. You know, what is that? You see a lake and somebody says, oh, it's water. And you know, well, water is good to drink. So you drink the lake and you die of toxic poisoning. Well, you were at the wrong level of abstraction for the description of what that phenomenon was. That phenomenon was not a body of water. It was at a lower level of abstraction. It was the appropriate level of abstraction to answer the question, is it good to drink? Is it good to drink requires knowing what kind of body of water it is. Is it a lake next to a toxic dump? That's one kind of body of water. Is it a lake that's in an alpine meadow that's fed by pristine springs? That's another kind of body of water. If you get the level of abstraction wrong for the description of the particular thing, wrong with respect to the problem you're trying to solve, the thing you're trying to explain, the task you're trying to achieve, then you can have catastrophic consequences. Now, when we look at economies, therefore, there's the same kind of question. What's the level of abstraction at which you want to describe the economic life and structures of a society? One level of abstraction is capitalism. This is the level of abstraction that in the Marxian tradition is called the mode of production. And if we analyze an economy and say, yes, it's a capitalist economy by the criteria of that abstract concept, that may be very useful for many things, but not for everything. It wouldn't help you to distinguish the particular dilemmas of working class struggles in the United States today and in Sweden, for example. Knowing that these are both capitalist economies is not sufficient to understand the particular dilemmas faced by class formations in these two places. You need a lower level of abstraction for that. Because it's at the lower level of abstraction that all sorts of other things besides just being capitalist become relevant to explaining what the obstacles to struggle are. A common error that occurs in sort of Marxian circles, as it were, in discussing these kinds of problems, a common error is to go to too high level of abstraction for the problem at hand, to imagine that the problems of strategy can be solved at a high level of abstraction, when in fact they can only be solved at lower levels of abstraction, where you then have varieties of the higher order. Well, in any case, what I'm going to do here today is the higher level of abstraction, right? So that's just to locate this problem. The first task at hand, though, is to really figure out what's this concept, capitalism, understood at a very high level of abstraction. All different varieties of capitalism, therefore, are all instances of this higher order concept. The fact that they are instances of the higher order concept, however, doesn't mean that the most important features of them are located at that higher level, because that depends upon what you're trying to explain. again, to go back to my Aussie example, if I want to know, if I want to have a pet that's going to be really good with children and be easily trainable, you know, if that's a problem I want to solve, knowing that it's a mammal isn't going to do me much good, right? So I get the pit bull rather than the corgi, because after all, they're both mammals. Knowing that it's a mammal isn't going to solve the problem of what's the best kind of pet for those particular purposes. Even though it's absolutely true, it's not a false statement that these are both mammals, or even that they're both dogs. Those are correct, both analytically, scientifically correct claims about the creature in question, but not at the right level of abstraction for the problem at hand. Are they going to bite my kids? And are they going to be easily trained? I may be impugning the integrity of pit bulls in this. I'm using them as an iconic bad dog, but I understand that it's bad owners, not bad dog, that make bad dogs, but that aside. So similarly, the fact that we're starting with capitalism, because we feel that is the kind of fundamental concept we need, and it's a fundamental concept particularly because we want to transform it into something else, which is what the critical points in the next lecture will be focused on. It does not follow from that for all of the problems you may be interested in, knowing that it's capitalist is sufficient to get to the heart of the question. That may just be a point of departure, and it's the variations in forms that's going to really be where the action is. So whatever your areas of interest are, this is a problem you have to contend with. What's the level of abstraction that's optimal for the task at hand? All right. Now, let's get down to capitalism. Is all that clear? Any queries? Don't wait for me to ask is that all that clear. Feel free to jump in and insist on an answer before I ask it. All right. Capitalism. The first task is to locate capitalism within what could be called a contrast space. A contrast space. So here's the issue here. Capitalism is a way of classifying a society in contrast to other ways of classifying. Right? So there's many different ways we can classify societies, right? Calling a society a capitalist society is one of the many ways we can do it. That's classifying a society by the nature of its economic structure and classifying its economic structure in a particular way, capitalism. So first thing to get clear is how this way of classifying is located among a family of possible ways of classifying. You all social theorists of one level of education or another. What are alternative ways of classifying societies? Just throw out some alternatives.
Political system.
Feudalism,
socialism, and a series of others. This is that those are that whole spectrum is the spectrum of classifications within which capitalism is located. So those are all classifying societies by their economic structures, understood as modes of production. But there are other ways of classifying societies. Yeah?
Gender, so male-dominated, patriarchal system, matriarchal system.
So you could classify societies by their gender relations.
Religious
beliefs. Judeo-Christian, Islamic, Buddhist, Confucian, sure.
Culture,
yeah, and sometimes that's Western versus Eastern. You know, there's all sorts of either sophisticated or lame ways of doing culture. Other things that are kind of strong in the sociological traditions, what would be?
Political system.
So you could, yes, authoritarian, democratic, liberal, monarchical, you could define societies by their dominant form of the state, yeah.
What about development, such as North versus South?
Well, I think North versus South is a shorthand for something else. After all, New Zealand and Australia are in the South, but they're
Right.
So it's a level of development.
Industrialization.
Right. So level. So there's a very common classification system of societies goes from hunter-gatherer to agrarian to industrial to post-industrial. A whole variety of claimants for the next phase, you know, knowledge society, information society, service society. There's all sorts of different ways of labeling the post-industrial phase, but that's basically classifying societies by their dominant technology and the level of development signaled by that technology. A very conventional sociological classification, it's not quite so common today, but it's still present, as modern versus traditional. The whole theory of modernity and modernization was the predominant way that American sociologists classified the world in the 50s, but there's still auras of that, and indeed this sequence, traditional, modern, postmodern, is another classification system. So for those of you who are sociology graduate students, this is a kind of a conventional prelim question, you know, to say the grand sweep of historical variations in societies is organized along various schema from the following list of five schemas, pick two and systematically contrast them. You know, traditional, modern, postmodern, hunter-gatherer, blah, blah, you know. So these are different ways of classifying. So capitalism gets its meaning in part from being part of one type of classification system compared to others. That's one way of giving the capitalism idea its specificity. It's classifying societies on the basis of the central principles by which the economy is organized. Now, the Marxian term for that is mode of production. I don't think a lot rides... Some people think a lot rides on calling it mode of production. I think that just happens to be the terminological convention that Marx adopted, and not consistently, by the way. He doesn't always talk about mode of production. I don't think he thought of introducing that expression as fully introducing a technical term. It was more just a way of signaling that he was talking about the structure of the economic system. So Jerry Cohen, in the book you'll be reading for 2 weeks, he spent a lot of time talking about relations of production, forces of production, modes of production, and so on. I think that's important to kind of just straighten out exactly how the words are being used, but it seems to me it's just fine to think of capitalism as an abstract way of describing the basic structure of an economy. Yeah.
What else does he call it besides a mode of production?
I mean, sometimes he refers to relations of production rather than the mode of production. Sometimes the mode of production is the relations of production and the forces of production together. I don't know if Marx uses the term economic structure. I think he does use something very close to that at times. I'm not much of a Marxologist, so my when you ask me questions about actual details of Marx's own corpus, you should always take it with at least a little caution. You know, you should always take anything a professor says with skepticism, but on that particular score, I'm likely to make mistakes. So one thing is this: capitalism is embedded in a particular typology of ways of organizing the economy called mode of production. And the second thing is it's a way of characterizing those economic structures at a very high level of abstraction. Now, there are people who say it's an illegitimate level of abstraction. That is, that there's nothing interesting that can be said at that level of abstraction. And I don't think that view should be dismissed out of hand. That is, the very abstract definition of capitalism makes early 19th century and early 21st century systems fall under the same rubric. And there may be very few questions that anybody cares about for which that's an important feature. It could be. So it shouldn't be taken for granted that this very high level abstraction is the proper way to do it. Some people, my colleague Fred Block, that may be a familiar name to some of you, he's a professor of sort of sociology, political economy at University of California, Davis. He argues that social democracy is really a fundamentally different economic structure, and that it's a mistake to call social democracy a la Sweden and American capitalism two varieties of the same system, that they're fundamentally different. They're as different from each other as either is from feudalism, let's say. They're just fundamentally different kinds of structures. All right. That's the question of the contrast space. I think this is a good point for a break. Let's reconvene at 10 after 11, and then we'll get down to the business of the actual structural definition of capitalism. So in the spirit that a 10-minute break should mean 10 minutes, I will relentlessly start. Oh, which reminds me, much to my dismay, because of the construction in front of the faculty club, although it's a very comfortable and pleasant lounge, they no longer serve coffee until the construction is done. And I think for both symbolic and physiological reasons, if we're going to have early morning office hours before class, having it in a coffee shop is desirable. I think, at least as an experiment to see if it's an okay setting, on Wednesday I'll be at Espresso Royale, which I think is the closest
On this side of State? Not the one down by the Capitol?
Yeah, there's one just across the first block of State Street. The first non-Starbucks. Right. So I will not hold office hours in Starbucks. The other option is Pete's in the Union, but I don't think the Union is as congenial, and it's not closer anyway. Then, so office hours on Wednesday will be in Espresso Royale rather than the faculty club because of the lack of coffee in the faculty club.
So. Bear in mind, though.
Well, I don't think they serve anything in the morning there.
I went in there when we were going to meet, and I was like, oh, is this the coffee bar? And they're like, oh, no, we don't do coffee anymore, but we have wine and beer. And
oh, yeah.
10:30 in the morning.
Yeah, well, I was assuming that a glass of wine at 8:30 or... Certainly it's not my way of getting the day going. So I will be there by 9 o'clock unless I get an email. I'm happy to be there earlier. You know, it's no problem for me. But sometimes I'll be there earlier anyway. But if you want to meet earlier, just let me know. Then I'll be sure to be there. Okay. All right. Let's see. Where's the outline here? Okay. So we are now at item 3 on the outline. Approaches to defining capitalism in the Marxist tradition. I'm going to very briefly discuss capitalism as a distinctive form of market society, just to get you familiar with a certain formalism that you'll encounter from time to time in Marxist discussions. But I prefer to approach this in a structural way, and that will be where I'm going to mostly put my energy. So one standard way that Marxists talk about capitalism is to distinguish capitalist economic transactions from a simpler form of market relations. So one of the tasks here is to say, yes, capitalism is a market form of market economy, but it's a very particular kind of market economy, and to distinguish it from what is called simple commodity production. There is a way of representing this symbolically, which is common enough. I think Marx introduced this formalism, and it's been followed through. The reading by Sweezy, the short reading, where he defines capitalism, uses this convention. So there's two terms in this convention. C stands for commodities, and M for money. Now, a commodity in the Marxian terminology means something that is produced for the purpose of exchange. commodities can be viewed in two lights. They have a usefulness. That's sometimes called a use value. Commodities are useful for people. That doesn't mean they're good for you. They just mean that they have a use. So cosmetics have a use, even if they are harmful. So a commodity is something that has a use value, but it also has what's called an exchange value. That is, one of the things you can do with commodities is exchange them for other commodities. When commodities directly exchange with each other, we call it barter. And so if you produce tomatoes in your garden and somebody else produces lettuce and you want lettuce and they want tomatoes and you trade, well, you've engaged in an exchange. The commodity exchanges for another commodity. It's useful to both parties. But there's no money involved. The direct exchange of commodities is therefore called barter, and that's the simplest form of exchange. But you can see that it's not very efficient. The direct exchange of one commodity for another has the problem that you have to find somebody in particular who wants your particular commodity. It's much better to have an intermediate step where you have some kind of token which everybody accepts as being valuable for exchange purposes, and you have commodities that you sell to somebody who gives you money, and then you use that money to buy other commodities. That's called simple commodity production, and it's represented by this little expression or formula as a sequence, CMC. Commodities exchange for money, and money exchanges for commodities. That's the kind of market that exists in more or less subsistence economies, where farmers produce food not for purposes of accumulating wealth, but for purposes of getting other commodities. They eat some of the food and they exchange it for other commodities, but they do it by going to markets, selling the food, and then buying shoes and tools or whatever. That's called simple commodity production. You produce things, you exchange for money, but the whole purpose of the exchange is to satisfy needs. You're selling something entirely to satisfy your needs, that is, by getting money to buy things you need. This is in contrast to capitalist commodity production and capitalist markets, where instead of beginning in the first phase with some commodities that you want to exchange, in the first phase you begin with a pile of money. And what you want to do is to use that money to get more money. And the way you do this is you purchase with that money a bundle of commodities, and then you use those commodities in a particular way in order to generate additional money. Now, the very simplest form of this is what was characteristic of merchant capitalism, where you buy commodities in one place, you transport them to another place, and then sell them. Now, that transportation process I consider part of the process of production. It's not the conventional way that Marxists talk about it. I think it's actually a labor process. You're transforming the product by moving it from one place to another. It's a very simple kind of transformation. It's a spatial transformation, but nevertheless, it's transforming the commodity by moving it from the place where it's produced to the place where it will be purchased and consumed. And you sell it for more than you paid for it. Primarily, you're able to do that because of from an economics point of view, the supply and demand conditions in the different places where you purchased it and where you sold it. Similarly, buying it and holding on to it and then selling it later is also a production process. That is, you're transforming it by giving it a temporal dimension that it wouldn't otherwise have. So if you buy the crops at the high season, store them, and then sell them in the middle of winter when there's a scarcity of them, that storage process is a very special and very limited kind of production process. Yeah?
Can I just ask, would it be maybe more accurate to say that you're transforming the value of the commodity and not the commodity itself?
Well,
corn is still corn, but it's more about...
Well, but it's corn in the summer versus corn in the winter.
Right, and that's what I'm saying. It's not... Corn in the summer is abundant and corn in the winter is...
But scary. Corn in the winter is a different phenomenon. So this may be just playing with words. So I don't want to push this too much. I think of corn in the winter as a different phenomenon. It's a different thing from corn in the summer. Right? It has a it has a different use. It really is it, and it takes effort and resources to transform corn in the summer into corn in the winter. You got to protect it from the mice. You know, so there's all sorts of things you have to do. They may be so limited that to call it a production process is a little bit of a stretch, but I think that's the spirit of this. But the key, of course, for capitalist commodity production is the most important parts is not simply buying at one point and then selling it at another point in place, but actually transforming it. So what you're buying when you lay out your money is inputs to a production process. And you buy all sorts of inputs. In the Marxist way of approaching this, there is a very simple and powerful classification of the inputs into primarily two kinds of inputs. You buy all sorts of physical inputs, some of which themselves may be produced as opposed to just natural raw materials, and you buy labor power. That is, you buy access to human effort. And you combine these two to transform the natural world into a product, which you then sell. And the whole purpose is to sell it for more than the cost of all those inputs. And that's referred to as M prime. You put a little prime after it to indicate that it's M plus an increment of M. Now, a lot of Marxist accounts of this process is concerned with how it turns out that you end up with more value at the end of the process than you did at the beginning. Why is there a surplus of value in that M prime? There's extra money there. How do you explain the M prime, that extra increment? We'll talk about that aspect of the problem when we get to the theory of exploitation in a couple of weeks. I don't think we need to delve into it here. The key thing, though, in this way of defining capitalism and differentiating it from other ways of organizing an economy is that capitalism is an economic system organized around the sequence MC, M prime. Simple commodity production is organized around the sequence CMC. Capitalism is organized around the sequence MC, M prime. That's one way of giving specificity to this concept. If you find an economic structure that has that MC, M prime form of exchange, you've got a capitalist economy. I prefer an alternative. It's not an alternative that's inconsistent with this first way, but I think it's in the end, it's a more informative and useful way for most of our theoretical purposes of specifying what exactly makes a capitalist system capitalist. I prefer to do what I would call a structural definition, which examines economic structures along two kinds of dimensions, which I refer to as the class relations of an economic structure and the mechanisms of economic coordination across units of production. When I say economic coordination, I mean what's the mechanism that coordinates all the different units of production in an economy? So I define then capitalism as a particular form of class relations and a particular form of economic coordination. Class relations, we'll spend again some intense discussions as to exactly what's meant by it, but the simplest way of describing it is class relations are the social relations through which the means of production are owned and power is exercised over their use. If you want a kind of simple, all-purpose definition of class relations that I'll be using, and I think this is at the center of Marxian understandings, class relations define a set of social relations through which the means of production are owned and power is exercised over their use. In a way, that last phrase, power is exercised over their use, you might think of it as redundant, since owned might imply power over the use. But I think it's useful to make it explicit, because ownership doesn't it's more than just power over the use of means of production. Ownership also, well, we'll discuss this later. It has a variety of other implications. In capitalism, the means of production are owned privately. They're not owned by the state. They're not owned by communities. They're owned privately. And the use of those means of production is controlled by those owners or their surrogates. So you have private ownership of the means of production, and the power over their use is either directly by those owners or by the people they hire to exercise that power, their surrogates. But means of production, of course, don't themselves produce anything. They have to be set in motion by laboring activity, right? You know, if you want to produce something, you have to assemble means of production and raw materials, but you also have to get people to actually use those means of production. In capitalism, labor is provided by workers who do not themselves own the means of production. And thus, in order to acquire an income, they have to somehow or other get connected to those means of production. We call that hiring, being employed in a firm. And this then defines the fundamental class relation of capitalism. It's a relation between capitalists and workers, people who own the means of production or their surrogates, and people who use those means of production to produce. That's the class relations dimension of the definition of capitalism. Now, by this definition of capitalism, if all firms were worker cooperatives, it would no longer be a capitalist economy. It would be a distinctly different kind of economy. If all means of production were owned cooperatively by the workers who use them, it would be what I call a cooperative market economy, not a capitalist economy. It would share some features with capitalism because it could still be a market economy. You're still, and it could satisfy even that first condition, MCM prime, right? That is, the worker cooperative could begin with some money. They could buy inputs, and then they could sell those inputs to have more money. So it would satisfy the MCM prime condition, but it wouldn't satisfy the class relations condition. And I think it would function in a fundamentally different way as a result. And this is one of the reasons why I prefer this, what I'm referring to as a structural definition that includes the distinctive class relations of capitalism along with its market relations, rather than just have the MCM prime specification of capitalism. All right, that's the class relations dimension. The economic coordination dimension is where the term markets enter. Economic coordination in capitalism is accomplished through, to use a cumbersome set of terms, decentralized voluntary exchange by privately contracting parties. So it's decentralized voluntary exchange by privately contracting parties. This is what's generally called free markets. And it's through this mechanism that prices and quantities of goods and services is determined. That's market coordination. Market coordination is conventionally contrasted to, for example, state coordination, where the state authoritatively allocates resources and sets prices. But market coordination can be differentiated from other types of coordination as well. Yeah.
If you introduce like a central bank or something that regulates interest rates and things of that nature, would you still consider it a free market since the state has a kind of subsidiary indirectly or actually directly?
Right. So a pure free market is an impossible social form. It would implode instantly. So the ideal type, highly abstract characterization of coordination in capitalism as entirely based on decentralized private voluntary contracting, etc., is an analytical fiction. No concrete capitalist society could possibly exist if the only mechanism of coordination of across economic units was to decentralized voluntary exchange. Capitalism always requires a variety of institutional and social constraints on those exchanges to make the exchanges themselves possible. This is what Durkheim referred to as the non-contractual foundations of contract. And it's what in contemporary economic sociology is referred to as the necessary social embedding of markets. Social embedding. Markets are embedded in social relations. They're not free, unfettered, purely individualistic, voluntary processes. Actual capitalisms always require institutions to ensure the conditions of exchange, and central banks are one of those institutions. And that's particularly important because of the problem of where the money comes from. You know, the M in this MC, M prime, is actually a very tricky component of the process, as we've all witnessed from the recent financial shenanigans. And the market itself cannot produce the money that's necessary for markets to function. The economic sociologist Karl Polanyi refers to a series of elements of capitalist production as being what he calls fictitious commodities, as opposed to real commodities, namely that they cannot themselves be produced in a commodified way. They cannot be produced according to the logic of capitalism. And he has three primary ones. One is land. Nature itself is not produced. It's something that is given. And therefore, if it's treated like a commodity, it will tend to get destroyed. So there's a basis for environmental critique. Second is labor. Human beings are not produced in factories. They're produced in families. They're produced outside of capitalist production. But they're producing an input that's used in capitalist production. But if they're treated as if they are just a commodity, you destroy the conditions under which people are produced. And the third is money. It's his third fictitious commodity, which if it's treated as if it was just an ordinary commodity produced like anything else, you destroy its value. So that's why you need state regulations on all three of those, of the environment, of labor, and of money, in order to reproduce the conditions under which markets can function. That's kind of standard bread and butter contemporary economic sociology. Fully compatible, I think, with the Marxian framework, although those are not distinctively Marxist views. All right, so we've got then these two key components: class relations of a particular sort, and a system of economic coordination at the center of which, the part that makes it distinctively a capitalist economy as a system of coordination, is the role of decentralized voluntary exchange by privately contracting parties. So it's not that that's the only thing going on in the economy, but it's the part of what's going on in the economy that renders it capitalist. Those are the core structural components of this very abstract concept of capitalism. Now, actual capitalist societies, of course, vary enormously in all sorts of ways. In the lecture notes, which I'll post, I list a bunch of these. I'll just give a couple. Capitalisms differ in the degree of competitiveness. How large are the units that are coordinated through the market? To what extent are the units of production in the market sufficiently big that they can, through the exercise of power, shape their interactions, as opposed to just being voluntary exchanges? So when Walmart enters into market relations, it's no longer entirely voluntary exchange between privately contracting parties. Whoops. Not the way it's supposed to be. No idea what that is. Too bad. It's no longer, that erodes the voluntariness of it, right? Because Walmart is powerful enough to force various terms upon suppliers. The degree of concentration and centralization of capital is one of the ways that capitalisms vary, and we can distinguish highly competitive capitalisms from less competitive capitalisms. Globalized capitalisms from capitalist economies that are cabined within the boundaries of a state and therefore more effectively regulated. capitalisms with strong associations of capital and labor versus capitalisms that are more freewheeling without collective associations of labor and capital. So there's all sorts of variations. The claim of the abstract concept, the claim of the Marxist tradition in spending as much time elaborating this abstract concept and theories about the abstract at this highly abstract level, the claim is that all of these complexities get their meaning by virtue of their connection to the more abstract concept. So these are variations of the components of the more abstract concept. The clarifying the abstraction, therefore, gives precise theoretical status to the complexity. Now, this points to two ways that you can add complexity to an analysis. You can add complexity systematically, because each of the complex elements is connected to the more abstract ones. So there's a kind of coherence principle between the more abstract level and the more complex level. So if, for example, at the more abstract level, we define capitalism as having a class relation between owners of the means of production and non-owners who sell their labor power to work, that defines this very abstract capital-labor relation, we can then say actual capitalisms will vary in the extent to which these abstract categories are collectively organized or not. Right, so that's a form of variation that's connected to the abstract category. Or actual capitalisms will vary in the extent to which there are large numbers of workers working for the same capitalist firm, or the firms are small. That's a variation in the way in which the labor force gets organized with, gets brought together in production processes relative to particular units of capital. So these would all be forms of complexity that get their specificity from their connection to that more abstract category. Now we get to even more difficult stuff. Dynamics. What I've defined so far is capitalism defined in purely structural terms. I've defined a set of social relations or processes which, if you have these configurations, you've got capitalism. You look at an economy, you arrive on a new planet, you've never been to, you know, Jupiter before, you discover on one of its moons there's a thriving economy, you look at it and you discover, aha, they have market coordination and they have a capital-labor relation. Capitalism on Titan. Titan's the moon of Jupiter, right? But this is only the starting point. The key part of the Marxian account of capitalism is not simply its structural properties, but its dynamic properties. How these structural properties set in motion a process that operates over time, which is what what is meant by the term dynamic. This is what Marx called the laws of motion, which get set in place by virtue of these structural features. There are two key mechanisms that generate dynamics in the Marxist account of capitalism. The first is competition. Each firm, in order to survive, must compete successfully with other firms. This is a kind of simple, obvious point. It's a point that Marx emphasized, but it's certainly a point that most economists would also agree to. Now, competition, however, should not be thought of as mainly a motivation by individual firms. You should not think of competition as mainly a question of greed or profit-seeking selfishness on the part of capitalists. Of course, capitalists may or may not be greedy. They may or may not be motivated by, at a personal level, by profit-seeking. That's not the point. The key idea here is that competition is a pressure which firms experience in order to stay in business. to say that capitalist competition generates a dynamic in capitalism is to say that it's something imposed upon the actors, not something which they freely choose. If you're going to play in this game, this is the way you have to behave because of the pressures generated on a firm. There are two main ways that, there are many subtypes, but there's two main kinds of ways that competition takes place. One way that you can compete is to lower your costs of production and thus increase productivity in ways that enable you to undercut rivals. Firms that abstain from this, a firm that says, I'm not going to engage in price cutting, I'm not going to try to lower my costs of production, if they abstain from this, they will eventually decline and disappear. It's not a choice if you're in a competitive environment in which that strategy of competition is taking place, because if you abstain from it and other firms engage in it, so unless you can get collusion for all firms to abstain from increasing productivity and lowering costs, unless you can accomplish collusion, you will eventually be undercut and be unable to sell your products. Now, cost reduction can occur through all sorts of ways. Now, there's no simple strategy for this. It can be done through technical change that increase productivity. It can be done by finding cheaper sources of inputs. It can be done by finding cheaper sources of labor. It can be done by moving production to places which have cheaper costs of production. So there's all sorts of ways that you can reduce costs. In the last 30 years, we've experienced new ways through outsourcing, which was not the typical way that costs were reduced in the past. But they're perfectly congruent with the standard logic of competition in the capitalist economy, that you, in order to survive, you respond to competitive pressures by trying to reduce your costs of production. And the result of this is, over time, a very broad trajectory of productivity enhancing technological innovation over time. You know, for reasons which we will discuss later, capitalism is unique in the history of economic development in having such a strong tendency for technical change in the conditions of production. And of course, that's one of the things which is seen as its virtue. There is a second way of competing which doesn't involve lowering costs, and that's figuring out new things to produce. So you don't have to lower costs if you come up with new products to sell, or selling old products to new consumers, people who haven't been previously exposed to the market. So if you figure out something new to sell and people want it, that's a way of competing with other firms without necessarily having to lower your costs. So expanding, that's referred to as expanding the market rather than just cheapening your production within a given market. And at times, that's an even more potent force of competition is market expansion rather than just cost reduction. The resulting drive for profits by reducing costs and expanding markets is these two things taken together is what gives capitalism its striking dynamism. And you have to think of these two things as going together. At some times and places, one or the other is the crucial issue. There are times when creating new markets is really where the action is. There are periods where it's hard to cut costs further, and that's not an effective way of competing, but opening up new markets is. So that's the first general source of dynamism is competition through these two types of strategies. The second source of dynamism is class conflict. So capitalists don't merely face the problem of competition with other capitalists. They also face a problem of resistance from their labor force. the second kind of social problem which capitalists face is extracting labor effort from the labor force. And that's also a spur for technological change, for new strategies of production, sometimes for shifting production from one place to another. This problem is intensified when workers organize collectively, but it shouldn't be thought of as just a question of kind of organized class struggle in the sense of unions and collective action on the part of workers. It's a problem even in a fairly atomized labor force, how to extract effort from workers. We will be discussing this in detail in a couple of weeks. There are many other aspects of the dynamics of capitalism, I think, but as a starting point, if you want to kind of have your bullet points in line for thinking about capitalism, you've got the structural properties, class relations, and market coordination, and then you have these dynamic mechanisms, competition and class conflict. These correspond to those two structural properties, right? The class conflict part corresponds to the class relations aspect, and the competition part corresponds to the market coordination. And that gives you both the structural and the dynamic features of capitalism. Quickly moving on. Contradictions within these dynamics. This, of course, is there's hardly a term that's more associated with the Marxist tradition than the word contradiction. And it's a word we will be revisiting again many times during the semester. To say that capitalism is dynamic is still not the end of its core story. Capitalism isn't just a structure. It's not just a dynamic structure. It's a dynamic structure that has internal contradictions within it. Well, what does contradiction mean? Here's how I would give you a synoptic definition. We will enrich this iteratively again. A contradiction means that there are chains of effects of a given process which disrupt the functioning of that process. So we can say a process has internal contradictions if it generates chains of effects which come back to disrupt the process itself. A process is non-contradictory if it produces consequences, but those consequences don't have any kind of feedback or side effects that come back to disrupt the process itself. So a process is contradictory if it has this character. Ramifications that can be thought of as chains of effects. It doesn't have to be simple as first order effect. It can be sequences of effects, which come back and undercut its own conditions of existence, so it disrupts it. Contradictions need not imply that the contradiction necessarily destroys the possibility of the process, it just disrupts it. The Marxian account of contradictions tends to add an additional layer, which we will interrogate at some depth at various times in the semester, namely that the contradictions have a tendency to intensify over time. Now that's a pretty strong claim. That means not only does the system function in such a way that it generates consequences which disrupts its own functioning, but these disruptions get more and more intense over time. That was what one might call revolutionary optimism, I think, on the part of Marx, because it made it more plausible that the system could eventually be transformed. If its tendency to undermine its own conditions of existence gets worse, it's not just a constant or cyclical tendency, it's an intensifying tendency. The reading by Harvey, which I included, both because of the kind of synoptic way which he tries to characterize capitalism, but also because he does talk about these kind of contradictory aspects, he lists a bunch of what he calls barriers to continued accumulation. I think there's six that he discusses. It's not quite as systematic a discussion as I would like, but I think it's a pretty good inventory of the sorts of problems which capitalism encounters and why capitalism is not a system of smooth and continuous uninterrupted growth, but of erratic, crisis-ridden and contradictory growth. Now, there's one final issue which I think I will begin the next lecture with, but I want to just give you what I want to talk about. And that's the shift in the analysis from why competition drives technical change and these dynamic processes, and why it forces firms to seek profits. The shift in the language from that to why competition generates capital accumulation. Now, this is not a trivial point. Competition explains why capitalists have to innovate. It doesn't explain exactly why they have to grow. And I think Harvey is way too facile on this. I don't think he answers the question he poses. He asks the question, why do capitalists reinvest in expansion rather than consume away their profits in pleasure? Well, they have to devote some of their profits to technical change, to lowering their costs, because otherwise they'll be driven out of business. But that's not the same as saying they have to expand. They don't have to get bigger, they just have to get more efficient under the competitive pressure. The competitive pressure forces you to lower your costs, because other firms are, otherwise you're going to be undercut. But why does a competitive pressure force you to actually keep reinvesting to get bigger and bigger? Now, I think it's an important issue, because the key to the dynamics of capitalism is not just profit making and not just using those profits to generate innovation, to lower costs, but it's also a growth machine. It's also expansion of capital. That is what's called capital accumulation. And the question is, what is the mechanism that makes that an integral feature of capitalism? And I think there are mechanisms, which I'll explain next time. I don't think Harvey gives us an account of that at all. He waves his hands at it. And that's where we'll begin on Wednesday.
When do you want us to turn in our discussion?